What makes the week what it is? How did society settle on 7 days? We're exploring these questions, the weekly rhythms of life, if you will, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The answer, according to one author, lies in hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history. David Hainkin is an historian at University of California, Berkeley, and his book is called The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. And it explores how the 7-day week came to be a cornerstone of our society. He talked about the book and his research with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
Before we get into the why, David, let's get into why this matters. So from your research, how have you found the 7-day work week affecting us, especially in ways that we might not even realize?
Well, truth is that I was interested not only in the 7-day work week, but all the other things that the week does. And I think that we're attuned to the fact that the 7-day work week gives us a certain kind of discipline, a certain kind of rhythm. And that's interesting just because it's sort of become a pretty much a global timekeeping cycle only really in the last century or so. So that's interesting in its own right. But I was especially interested in how it is, even beyond the rhythms of work and not work, the cycle of 7 different days has come to seem so natural to us. It feels like a part of like the fabric of our lives, the sort of the anchor of our memory and all these other things that go beyond simply the separation between labor and leisure. And then when I began this book, I didn't know exactly all the things that it did. I didn't even know exactly how it had come to do those things, but I was convinced that the 7-day week was a technology that performed all kinds of things for us and performed all sorts of things on us as well.
So, and as you write in the week, in contrast to months and years, a 7-day cycle does not form neat fractional subsets of any larger calendar unit. So what makes the week unique then compared to the other ways we keep track of time?
Well, a couple of things. One is not about its uniqueness, but about its independence. In other words, because the week is not a fraction or a portion of a month or a year or a century or a decade or any of that, it kind of is like this separate calendar with its separate history. We might think of it as part of the Gregorian calendar, but it's much older than the Gregorian calendar. It's been observed by many societies that didn't use the Gregorian calendar, and it has its own rhythms that are independent of it. So that's one thing, is that the week is an independent calendar. And the other is the fact that it's not even suggested really by anything in the observable universe means that it is, we know when we think about it, it's not universal, it's not necessary, it's in some ways arbitrary, and many societies have done just fine without that. And then the final thing I would add is because the week is not a portion of or naturally identified with any observable cycle, it means that it's associated with human memory and human record keeping in a pretty unique way. I mean, if we lost track of other units of time, something in our experience would let us know that we had gotten off track. But the week depends entirely on conventions of human scheduling and conventions of human record keeping, which is one of the reasons why we get so upset when we forget what day of the week it is, because we're aware on some level that the week is a vulnerable timekeeping system. It is vulnerable in the same way that human memory is vulnerable.
Wasn't that one of the experiences of the pandemic for just about all of us, though, was the way that days ran together and us stopping to wonder what is the difference between a Tuesday and a Thursday anyway?
It's a little interesting to me that we focus so much on the week, given the fact that our shutdown experience ought to have confused day and night also, and ought to have confused the times of the year. In some ways, that was a more obvious disruption of our lives. Those of us who were used to spending the day outside the house and the evening inside the house suddenly had spending all time inside the house, and also many annual events like proms or World Series or things like that were affected or postponed by. But instead, we complained about the week. which I took as a sign that we are all very, very much attached to the week above all other calendar units, as the anchors of our habits, and also the anchors of our experience of memory, which I think what your question was suggesting. Yeah.
So as we're all anchored to this week, but the week seems to be arbitrary, at least in the larger calendar units that we use in the bigger picture of things. So David Henken, your new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are, just how unnatural are these rhythms that we've taken for granted? And in the context of the week, what do you mean with these unnatural rhythms?
Well, by unnatural, I just mean that they're really a sort of a conventional technology for how to divide up time. There are lots of conventional technologies for dividing up time, and most of them are rooted in things like the movements of celestial bodies or the tides or patterns of weather or things of that. The week is not, which is why many parts of the world did not observe a continuous cycle of 7-day increments the way that we do. But now that we do, and now that everyone else does, and now that we use it to organize our lives and schedule our activities, it seems quite natural, right? It seems like today really is, in some sense, a Thursday. And if you think it's not a Thursday, and then you discover it is, it throws you because it feels like you had misunderstood something about the natural world, not just something about your schedule.
It sounds like the rest of our technology is built on this ancient technology that we call the week.
We use many techniques and many machines to track time. The week is a weird one because it is an ancient technology. And so we usually think that modern timekeeping is different from ancient timekeeping in various ways. And the week doesn't fit into any of those distinctions. The week is artificial rather than natural, which is the opposite of what we think. We think of the ancient ones as natural and the modern ones as artificial. The week is cyclical, not linear. We don't think of the artificial ones as being cyclical, but this one is. The week is really a kind of outlier, and I do think of it as an ancient technology.
David Henken, our guest here on the Ideas Network. He is a historian at the UC Berkeley and also the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. So, David, your book talks about how the week came to be accepted here in the United States. And it's interesting that you juxtapose Cotton Mather and Benjamin Franklin, who both came up with systems for the 7-day cycle. How did the week become so commonplace across so much of this country?
Okay, so I mean, the very simple answer at how the week came to North America is that Europeans and Africans brought it with them. The people who came to North America, either voluntarily or in chains, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries were by and large people who were familiar with the week. In the grand scheme of global history, that they weren't necessarily the majority, but they already understood many of the things that the week can do. And both Benjamin Franklin and Cotton Mather, who both essentially were descended from generations of Puritans, were familiar with a particular use of the week to take stock of one's life, to assess how productive one had been, to measure one's shortcomings, to resolve to do better in the next week. Cotton Mather did so within a very sort of classically Puritan theological framework, having to do with duties toward God. Franklin, who was raised in that culture, but came to embrace other ideas about religion, used it in a more sort of familiar secular way as a kind of self-help, moral self-improvement, but both of them thought of the week in that way. My point is that the week has done different things for different people, and in 18th century North America, it was already quite familiar to lots of people, both as a system of dividing labor from leisure and as a technology of taking stock. But what I'm interested in the modern world is the way a very different use of the week has come to take over. So in addition to those two and some others, most of us are anchored to the week by schedules. We use the week as a technique for making plans with friends and for scheduling activities with strangers. And in many ways, that's what makes Tuesday and Wednesday so fundamentally different for each of us, is that we have routines, things that we do every 7 days, or sometimes things we do every 14 days or every 28 days, but things that are attached to particular days because of our schedule. And that's something that most people in the United States didn't do in 1800. but that masses of ordinary people in the United States were already doing by about 1850. So in some ways, that is the birth of a particular function of the seven-day week that I think of as its most classically modern feature.
That is historian and author David Hankin talking with WPR's Lee Rayburn about the history of the seven-day week, how it came to be. We'll pick up this conversation in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring how the seven-day week came to be. 7 days. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UC Berkeley historian David Hankin's book is called The Week, and here's more of his conversation with my colleague Lee Rayburn.
Let's go back to, for a moment, if we could, the role of imperialism and colonialism and how you see that, David, defining and instilling the seven-day week.
All right, so imperialism and colonialism are powerful forces in the spread of timekeeping technologies. In the case of the week, though, it's a little complex. So for example, European imperial powers impose new calendars on their various colonial territories. Some of those colonial territories already observed the seven-day week. So I'll give you one sort of obvious example. In the Muslim Mediterranean world in North Africa, the imposition of a Gregorian solar calendar onto a Muslim lunar calendar was the occasion for great conflict and confusion and resistance. But the use of the seven-day week was seamless because both of those societies counted a seven-day week and agreed on where we were within the cycle, even if they didn't necessarily use the week for the same purposes. In other places, like in East Asia, military conquest, imperial expansion, and especially the spread of Western capitalism introduced a week in lands that had never counted continuous cycles of 7 days. You'll see a much bigger change for in places like Japan and China, which were not, formally colonized in the same way than you would in places like Egypt or Iraq.
David Hankin, our guest, he is the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. He's a historian at UC Berkeley. And David, how has this week technology, how has this been able to persevere throughout time? How has it been able to, you know, throughout the 19th century and all the other technologies that have developed, how has it persevered?
There are a lot of remarkable things about it. One is that none of the societies that have counted 7 day weeks have ever disagreed about where we are, like what phase of the cycle we're in. And that's remarkable given how many conflicts there have been, even within societies about calendars and timekeeping. The week seems to have created a common ground within and across those societies that have observed it. Maybe the more obvious mystery of the week is how it has survived very powerful and in many ways reasonable attempts to remove it. So I'll give you three examples. These are the three most famous assaults on the week. One took place in the late 18th century, and it was in the French Revolutionary calendar, which sought to replace the 7 day week with a 10 day, what they called a decade, a 10 day cycle of time. It would be completely independent of, obviously, the 7 day week. That was designed in large part to undermine the power of the Catholic Church in France. Within a few years, it was clear that the French populace was not getting rid of its seven-day week, or for that matter, its weekly patterns of church attendance. The second famous example would be another revolution. So fast forward from the 1790s to the 19-teens and 20s in the Soviet Union, where the Bolsheviks, also interested in undermining the power of an entrenched Christian church, in the case the Russian Orthodox Church, made calendar reforms, serious calendar reforms, many of which were successful. This one was not. What they first tried to do was create a 5 day week and then a 6 day week. And what they wanted to do was, in some ways, even more radical. They wanted to make a staggered, a non-coordinated week, so that not everyone would have the same day off. This was designed also to create continuous production in Soviet factories, and it too failed after a couple of years. And the seven-day week returned there as well. The third example is less well known, but is at least as interesting, and that is in the capitalist West, led by businesses in the United States, but embraced by reformers in Europe and in North America. There was a plan to just tweak the week in a very small way, not to change its length and not to to break its coordination. In other words, not to stagger it across the population, but just to make it fit into months and especially years. So several companies, most famously the Kodak Corporation, introduced a new calendar for all of its internal purposes. And calendars like that became the model for an international calendar reform movement that sought basically to introduce a 364-day year with extra days at the end, and those extra days, either one or two, depending on whether it was a leap year, would have no place in the weekly cycle.
It's a day without a day of the week?
Exactly. One or two days that are what you might call extra hebdomadal, right? They stand outside the seven. Now, it's not that weird if you think about it. We do it all the time with holidays. We still call Monday of Labor Day Monday, and the next day is Tuesday, but Monday doesn't feel like a Monday when it's Labor Day, and Tuesday doesn't feel like a Tuesday from the perspective of the work week if it falls after Labor Day. But we still go ahead with our count. But what this calendar reform sought to do was to go from, let's say, Friday, December 31st to a holiday, mm-hmm. and then the next day would be Saturday, January 1st. And if you did that, then January 1st would be Saturday every year in perpetuity. Huh. So you wouldn't have all these problems. You wouldn't need a new calendar each year. You could organize the months there so they'd have the same number of weeks. Every year would have the same number of working days. It made a lot of sense, and it didn't seem to cause such a problem. I mean, the French Revolution wanted to go to a 10-day week. That was a big change. The Russian Revolution wanted to have people have assigned to different weekly calendars. That's really complicated. All this reform wanted to do was to add one or two days a year that stood outside the week. And there are lots of reasons to think that these reforms would pass because they were embraced by the same people who were talking about things like having time zones, having international agreement about where the dateline was, having moving the clocks forward an hour in the summer and then reverting back in the winter. All these things that we do, right?
Right.
They all succeeded. The one thing that didn't succeed was this reform.
David, so with your research and with your book, The Week, I have to ask, is the concept of the seven-day week becoming obsolete? And if not, should it be?
Well, I think the history of the week in the last 200 years would suggest the opposite, that far from becoming obsolete, it has become universal and much more entrenched. There are some developments in the last 20 to 30 years that might suggest that it's weakening its grip on us. Some of the obvious ones would be things like remote work or synchronized work across the dateline. So all these things that make it less crucial to schedule activities by day of the week and make it less obvious what day of the week it is for all of us. Another one that we sometimes underestimate is the decline of synchronized entertainment. For many people, certainly in my generation and generations prior, the character of each day of the week was shaped by what was on TV,
right,
or shaped by movies or shaped by radio programming or things of that sort. That is, of course, no longer the case. We are raising generations of people who consume their entertainment almost entirely asynchronously, with the significant exception of sports. So there are reasons to think that the week is might be less important 20 years from now than it was 20 years ago. And yet it really does seem entrenched. And my research suggests that the week is very, very hard to change and seems almost impossible to extirpate, to uproot. I found no examples of societies that abandoned the 7-day week. And all of our complaining during the pandemic about Blur's Day, you know, the week is this day, that day, the other day, all those things suggest to me that we are far more attached to the week than I would have thought before the pandemic. I would have thought maybe the pandemic would have shown that with our electronic calendars and our asynchronous entertainment and our remote working, that we don't really need the week anymore. That really is a kind of an artifact of industrial society, not post-industrial society. But all that complaining that we all did, myself included, about what day of the week it was, suggested to me that it is very, very hard to shake the mental habits that have grown up around the week, both individually and collectively as a society.
David Henkin, thank you for giving us the time to stop and consider the week.
Thank you. Lovely talk to you, Lee.
And that was historian and author David Henkin talking with WPR host Lee Rayburn on the 7-day week. Stick around this hour as we explore when the COVID pandemic could become endemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, we talk about the COVID pandemic to endemic and what that shift will mean for COVID response in our daily lives. Do you think we're past the pandemic or are we not out of the woods yet? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how a box of old cassette tapes connected a Madison musician with his father and his heritage.
Clint Greendeer is a musician and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. This is his story about discovering a box of old cassettes and how restoring and archiving the songs on those tapes has connected him with his heritage and his father.
Yeah, those great memories, you know, being raised in my family. It's my mom, my dad, and I'm the youngest out of five, so I'm the baby. A lot of it's like my dad just taking me to Ho-Chunk ceremonies, singing in the car to and from, learning a lot of these songs that are important to us because we're the ones who remember them and keep them going and keep passing them on. My Jaji, or my dad, Conroy Greendeer Sr., he's an amazing singer, and he knew hundreds and hundreds of songs. And my memories of him, you know, listening to other musicians and stuff, he'd still always kind of link that in with our own culture and our heritage. We would definitely be listening to some rock, like Guns N' Roses and stuff, or B.B. King, Louis Armstrong, like, my dad, he'd always kind of say, like, they all have such beautiful voices and such range. Like, imagine if they were singing all these Wungshik songs with us. Like, that'd be phenomenal. I'd be like, Dad, I don't know if, like, Louis Armstrong is really going to be at the powwow or anything like that, but... My dad passed away about 6 years ago now, I think. Yeah, we came across all of his tapes. He has a huge tape collection. It's got to have hundreds of tapes in there. It's got language tapes. It's got powwow tapes, songs for our ceremonies. A lot of my family kind of reiterated to me, like, oh, gee, you know, your dad has a lot of really important, you know, songs and teachings in all of those tapes. Like, you know, someone should really try to digitize those or something, because, you know, tapes, they can degrade and eventually, you know, they can break. And I was like, okay, well, I should take it upon myself to go through these tapes and at least get them in a digital format, and it's going to be a resource that, you know, myself and younger ones than I will be able to learn from too. our Ho-Chunk songs, yeah, they go back ice ages ago. They're passed down to us from our ancestors, and that's why my dad, he always put a lot of importance and significance into making sure that he taught me these songs so that, you know, that we can keep these songs alive, keep them going. It's significant to us because, yeah, we're the ones that sing it. We're the ones that teach it to our younger relatives. Well, I was kind of going through the tapes, and then I kind of came across one section where it was just my dad singing by himself, and me just hearing that, you know, it's a very, like, intimate recording of, like, just my dad, and it's, you know, I felt like he was in the room with me. When I come across tapes like those, that's where, you know, I kind of get a, you know, a chill up my spine, because it's, that's a certain kind of energy and certain kind of moments that, you know, I've personally haven't been around because I was so young. I hear those tapes and I'm like, oh yeah, this is why I'm doing this. These are the moments that I love to document. Those kind of moments are great to revisit because it comes to show, you know, he's really not that far away. It's a bit of a tedious and daunting task, but I don't know, it feels good to try to keep those moments, those recordings alive. At least so they can play one last time for me to record it. That's all I need the tape to do. I just need you to get through that one more time playing. All right. My experience with music, it was a different pathway that my dad took. I mean, the path I took was more playing guitar in a band. It's kind of interesting to listen to moments and tracks that, you know, he recorded in his, like, 20s or getting towards his 30s, and that's, like, my age now, and it's great to kind of listen to things that he was making at my age. That's such a cool little time capsule for me. It's been cool that I'm able to learn from my dad and still add a little bit of what I've learned through my life, my experience, and being able to make that connection into something completely new. Could I do a send-off in Ho-Chunk? Shige honey chuck jawi. See you again.
Clint Greendeer is a musician and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Original guitar music, including this song, is by Clint Greendeer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And just ahead, public health experts are sussing out what life may look like once COVID transitions from pandemic to endemic. That is, becoming a disease always present with us but remaining predictable. Are we there yet? What behaviors from the pandemic, what lessons learned should we keep at the forefront of our minds to avoid another surge? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network.
Mm-hmm.
We're discussing pandemic to endemic on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Something to bear in mind, courtesy of medical news today, the term pandemic, epidemic, and endemic, they do not describe the severity of a disease. Rather, they describe its prevalence. So this means that one is not inherently worse than the other. So with that in mind, do you think we're past the pandemic stage? What questions do you have about an endemic phase and what that means for you and your loved ones? 800-642-1234. Mark Johnson is a health and science reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, let's start with definitions so that we can get on the same page. Tell us the difference between an epidemic, a pandemic, and an endemic.
Sure. An epidemic is a disease that's in the middle of a sudden, rapid spread. It becomes a pandemic when it sweeps across continents or even the whole world, as COVID-19 did. It becomes endemic when it is at a fixed sort of general permanent part of our medical landscape. An example would be influenza or HIV.
We've heard a lot of comparisons there to flu, having something that is fixed, general, and permanent, as you say. So when we're talking, as the worldwide death toll officially passes 6 million, you know, as we enter year 3 of pandemic, what do the epidemiologists look at to reach the conclusion that we're now in an endemic? You know, once we get there, what are they looking at?
I think they're looking at the number of cases, and especially cases and hospitalizations. The problem is that I've talked to a lot of doctors who feel we're already in the endemic phase. Generally, the U.S. counts have been going down precipitously. Our 28-day number of cases is at 2.2 million, which is 6 times lower than it was just 4 weeks ago. The problem is that it's not the same around the world. Other countries are in different stages. Some of the hotspots worldwide are like Russia, Austria, Norway, United Kingdom, Chile, Uruguay, and they're at much, much higher levels than what we're seeing.
And that really gets at, how do you make that call when we've reached an endemic, when the world isn't in lockstep, as you say, like not experiencing the same number of cases and hospitalizations, not experiencing deaths in a uniform way?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think it was up to the World Health Organization to declare a pandemic. And I think it's probably a good idea for the World Health Organization to weigh in terms of whether it's become an endemic or whether it's reached the endemic phase. The thing is, I think they're both kind of judgment calls. And just to give you an idea of the difference between case rates, in the U.S. now we're seeing about 12 cases per 100,000 people. Austria is seeing 355 cases per 100,000 people. So it's seeing the kind of rapid spread that we were seeing several months back.
You mentioned the WHO making a call on when we've turned the corner. What about our own CDC? What role will the CDC have in this?
Actually, I'm not entirely sure. I think that the CDC obviously weighs in on, it would probably be more involved in determining whether the disease is at an endemic level in our country. A disease can be endemic to one place and still at a different stage in another country. Mm-hmm. For instance, HIV is considered endemic in Africa, but in other places it might not be considered that.
So once we do reach an endemic phase, could we backslide once again into a pandemic with COVID?
We could. That's a very good point. Part of the problem with this this pandemic is that the virus that we were dealing with is a completely new virus, and at a number of different stages, it's fooled everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely possible that in one of these countries where there's very poor vaccination rates, and our vaccination rate now is about 65%, but I counted this morning, there's 52 countries that are under 33%.
Wow.
And there's 17 countries that are under 10%.
Mm.
So those are prime breeding grounds for a virus to just take off like wildfire.
So once you're in an endemic phase, will you need regular vaccines and boosters? What are the physicians telling you there?
Yes, most likely we will need regular boosters or vaccines. I don't think they're entirely sure yet how often we're going to need them. That's one of the things that the virus has sort of surprised us. I think that the immunity provided from the vaccines wore off a little bit faster than people expected, which is why you had cases of people who were vaccinated and then had breakthrough infections.
Hmm. I wonder then how much impact does the COVID vaccine have on getting us into the endemic phase? What is the correlation there?
Well, if it's effective enough to slow case rates down to a level where they're not overwhelming hospitals, then I think we start to move toward an endemic rate. I think that a number of the epidemiologists I've talked to are sort of on the fence about whether the vaccines are there yet. And the vaccines that we're taking this year, keep in mind that they may not be the vaccines we're taking next year. I think that a number of the vaccine makers have recognized that it would be very helpful to have a vaccine that gives you immunity for longer than 6 months.
A universal vaccine, too, has been the talk, a super vaccine that could take care of multiple variants. Is that still in the cards?
I think so. I mean, as early as the SARS epidemic, there were people that were scientists that were looking at trying to develop vaccines that would be usable for all coronaviruses.
Mm-hmm.
That would include the cold and, you know, other like SARS-1. I think that's still a goal. And if I think there's talk as well of getting a vaccine that would be effective with both COVID-19 and flu. I don't know how complex. I think that would be pretty complex to develop, and I think we're probably years away from that.
Mark Johnson, with us, health and science reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, has been writing extensively on the pandemic over the last couple years. As we enter year three, what is on your mind? Do you think we're past the pandemic, and are we now into an endemic phase? What shift in mindset do you have there, and what should we bear in mind as we make that transition or not? 800-642-1234. Mark, some experts have warned against using the word endemic to signify the end of a public health crisis because a disease in an endemic phase can still be wide-reaching. It can still be deadly. Should we not, you know, for lack of a better word, trick ourselves into thinking endemic is safe and, you know, synonymous with normal life?
I think that's actually a very good point. I think that the terminology is reassuring, but maybe a little bit too reassuring right now. I think it's probably safer and a better plan to be cautious. As I said, this particular virus has fooled the experts a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the scientists I've talked to have said that Omicron is unlikely to be the last variant that we see. Right now, the virus is one of the hot spots is Australia. That was an area that was very well protected. They had very strict restrictions as far as allowing people in. That meant that their population had very low levels. But once the virus gets in, it's like a match lighting dry wood. It can just, it's got this huge population of hosts that are all sort of open season in terms of infections.
Here's another thing to bear in mind and to watch. The USDA saying up to 75% of emerging infectious diseases in humans are zoonotic, that they're passing between species from animals to humans. What do scientists say about the potential for any of these new variants that animals might pass back to humans, potentially mutating into something, totally new?
Well, that's already happened, actually. In, I believe it was 2020, there was an outbreak of COVID-19 on some mink farms.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, I believe what happened was workers got COVID-19 first. They gave it to some of the mink. It spread very, very quickly among the mink. And then there were actual documented cases of mink spreading it back to humans.
Mm.
Now, the thing that worries scientists and all that is that when a virus is inside a different species, it has a different environment to adjust to. And its DNA will make, will change. It adapts to its environment. So when it comes out of mink after coming from humans, it may not be, in fact, it probably won't be the same virus that we saw before, at least the same variant.
Mm-hmm.
It will, in terms of its DNA, it will look different. And that difference could include mutations that may make it faster spreading or more virulent.
We're almost out of time here, but I'm just wondering, as you've covered this pandemic from the outset, what are you watching for next?
I'm watching for two things. One is how quickly we get vaccine to some of the countries that have very, very low vaccination rates.
Mm-hmm.
The last that I heard, I think the entire continent of Africa was at about 10%, which is very, very low for vaccination rate. As long as there are inequities in terms of the countries, that have vaccinated their populations, those are places where the virus can thrive and where we can get
significant spread and variants. Mark, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Mark Johnson covers health and science for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Stay with us for a conversation on burnout, knowing the signs, how best to handle mental exhaustion and prolonged stress. Are you doing too much, or do you feel like there's just too much to do? Let's talk about burnout, what you're experiencing. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.